vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. The reading is from Bhagavatam, chapter 85. The Lord Krishna instructs Vasudeva. And we're going to read a few texts. We'll concentrate on the first text right now. You can read it. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha. Hasan Marichik Satputra. Unayam Satamang Tare. Devak. Sam jahasu viksha sutam nabitu ubhatam. Chant, Vaishnavi. Shri Bhagavan Vacha, the Supreme Lord said, Asan, there were, Mariche, of Marichi, Sat, six, Putra, sons, Urnayam, born of Urna, his wife, Patame, in the first, Antare, rule of Manu, Devaha, demigods, Kam, at Lord Brahma, Jahasu, they laughed, Viksha, seeing, Sutam, with his daughter, Saraswati. Yabitum, to copulate. Rudyatam, prepared. Translation. The Supreme Lord said, during the age of the first Manu, the sage Marichi had six sons by his wife, Urna. They were all exalted demigods, but once they laughed at Lord Brahma when they saw him preparing to have sex with his own daughter. Text 48, 49, we can say together.
Tenasurim aganyoni adhuna vajakarmana iranyakashipojata nithaste yogamayaya devakya udhve jata rajan kamsha vimshitaha satan shochatya abhmajan swams na ne jyasate nithike.
Because of that improper act, they immediately entered a demoniac form of life, and thus they took birth as sons of Aranyakashipu. The goddess Yogamaya then took them away from Aranyakashipu, and they were born again from Devaki's womb. After this, O king, Kamsa murdered them. Devaki still laments for them, thinking of them as her sons. These same sons of Marichi are now living here with you. Purport. Acharya Sridhar Swami and Vishwanath Chakravarti explained that after taking Marichi's six sons from Aranyakashipu, Lord Krishna's Yogamaya first made them pass through one more life as children of another great demon, Kalanini. And then she finally transferred them to the womb of Devaki. Text 50.
Itta etam paneshyamo matrishoka panutaye Kataksha padvinir mukta lokam yasyanti vishraraha.
Translation. We wish to take them from this place to dispel their mother's sorrow. Then, released from their curse and free from all suffering, they will return to their home in heaven. Purport. As pointed out by Srila Prabhupada in his purports to chapter 2, texts 5 and 8 of his canto, Marichi's sons were condemned for their offense against Lord Brahma, and in addition, Aranyakashipu once cursed them to be killed by their own father in a future life. This curse was fulfilled by Vasudeva's letting Kamsa murder them one by one. And the last one.
Smarauda gitak parishvanga patangakshu drabhridrini sadime mat prasadena punayashanti sadgatim.
By my grace, these six, Smara, Udgita, Parishvanga, Patanga, Shudrabrit, and Drini will return to the abode of pure saints. Purport. These are the names of the six children first had when they were sons of Marichi. The oldest, Smara, was called Kirtiman when born again to Vasudeva, as recorded in Srimad Bhagavatam 10.157.
Kirtimanam sampatama jam kamsayana kadum dubhi arpayam asakritrenam so mrita ati divhala.
Vasudev was very much disturbed by the fear of becoming a liar by breaking his promise. Thus, with great pain, he delivered his first son named Kirtiman into the hands of Kamsa. I think it was Hari Parayana Prabhu that kind of went through this whole history with you. And he did a lot of research to find out who was who and what relatives and how it all was very much in an inter-family incident that these sons were killed by relatives. And so I won't go over that again. I don't think I could even repeat it. It was so complicated. Something like this Bhagavatam hierarchy is very complicated. But the point here is that the grandsons of Lord Brahma, because Marichi was the son of Brahma, so the grandsons, they actually noticed that Lord Brahma was doing this this act of chasing his daughter. His daughter was very charming, and as it may happen, even on the higher rank
Even the demigods, one can fall prey to the sex life. And Prabhupada is repeatedly pointed out, and many times in the Bhagavatam it is expressed that none of us are free from being captivated, can escape this captivation of sex life. And even the demigods here are subject to it. You also remember that Lord Shiva, he was attracted to Mohini Murti, even though he was warned. They said, don't even look at her. You know, don't have anything to do with it. But he says, I can handle it. But guess what? Even Lord Shiva couldn't handle it. So of course that was Krishna in the form of Mohini Murti. But anyway, it's definitely something that we need to hear again and again, that it is very hard to escape. But these sons of Marici, they had a little concession, because as you see, they were kind of escorted from having to go from this curse to that curse by Yogamaya. And she was kind of, seemed like she was responsible to bring them all the way through this whole, this retaliation of this offense of laughing, back to the heavenly planet, and they became saints again. So this is something that I'm sure was a blessing for them, not just to be left out there at the mercy of all these demons, but she made sure that they came back. So the Bhagavatam is kind of full of these stories of these incidents that are supposed to make a mark on us. We're supposed to remember and that this, or in this instance, that to be offensive can have some very heavy results. And there's another incident very kind of similar to this that I can think of. It's about the eight Vasus. And it happened at one time, there was a great personality, Mahavishya, and he was known for doing wonderful sacrifices and very pious person. He was very much attracted to the king at that time, Pratipa. And he got the benediction to go to Lord Indra's place because of all his sacrifices. And he was there, and lots of things were going on, and Ganga Devi was there. And it just so happened that a wind came up, and it blew off her garments. And so everybody went like, oh my gosh, except for this Marisha. And he was just like, wow. And and so she noticed that he didn't, you know, kind of even blink. And but this Marisha, other people realized that he didn't do the proper etiquette. So he was cursed, and he was cursed to have to come back to Earth again and take a human birth, and a mother of a human. And so this was like, oh my goodness. But he said, just this one lifetime, and then you'll come back. And so Marisha said, well, golly, I have to be in a human mother. But he says that can I be the son of King Pratipa? Can I come back as that? And so he said, okay, that's okay. And so then when Ganga Devi left that assembly, she was remembering this Marisha. And Mahavishya, yeah. And on the way out, she came across these eight Vasus who were lamenting. They had just received the curse also. And it just so happened that these Vasus were caught red-handed, that they had stolen Nandini. Nandini was the cow of Shishtamuni. And Shishtamuni cursed them also to have to come to Earth. But the head of that little group of Vasus was Dayo and Gyal. And because he was the leader of the pack, he got an extra curse. And he says that these others, they'll take care of their business. But you, Gyal, you will take birth, that you will be born as a very virtuous person. You'll be very learned in all the Vedas. You'll be very powerful, but you will not have any sons. And you won't even get to enjoy womanly pleasure. And so this was their curse. And so they were lamenting, and Ganga Devi, you know, heard the story. And they said, "Oh, Ganga Devi, could you please be our mother?" And she agreed to that. And then, so who's going to be your father? And said that, "I want the son of King Pratipa to be my father." And his name was Chandra. So out of this came something very good. Who? Bhishma Dev, right. So this was a benediction. So we can see that out of this story too, there has to be some retaliation for these offenses. But at the same time, usually it comes out good. So here we also see that these sons, they were born of Devaki, which is a wonderful thing. And they had to suffer, but now they're being returned. And they get to see Krishna, of course, and they get to return to the princely state. So we have to be very careful. We have to listen to these stories and realize that we're not exempt from offenses, from making fun of other devotees or even other people. It's not our position. And it's not like any rock is left overturned. Krishna sees everything, the demigods and Yamaraj, everybody sees what we do wrong. So we have to watch our P's and Q's. I looked it up what P's and Q's meant, and they couldn't really figure out the beginning of it all, but P's and Q's means be well behaved. And it actually says no offense. So we cannot be offensive, and we have to be on our best behavior all the time. Because it's difficult being a devotee. We have to walk very gently. We don't want to make it any more difficult than it already is. We have to, you know, be very, very much conscious that we could complicate our spiritual life by being offensive. You know, we have it easy going now, but it could really get complicated if we make offenses. So best to walk very gently. So a little bit about Devaki. Of course, we know that she was kind of prone to austerity and anxiety. She did all this austerity to get Krishna as her son. Two times, as we've been hearing, she had the partial expansions of Krishna, now the original expansion of Krishna. The other two were Brahmanadeva, like we heard yesterday, and then also Prishnagarbha. Prishnagarbha was the one that appeared before Dhruva Maharaj and created that whole planet, Dhruvaloka, for him. But now Krishna is appearing as her son in his original form. And of course, the whole story is that, you know, he left right away. But he told her not to worry, that really you're not going to be separated by me. You're always be remembering me. And so it is true. After 11 years, Krishna came back. He had left Mathura. Now he's coming back 11 years later. And that affection, Devaki still has that intense affection towards Krishna. And even towards these lost six sons, still that motherly affection is there. Prabhupada said that this motherly affection is the closest thing to real love for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that attraction is there between mother and child, as demonstrated here by Devaki. Literally, they're joined together by the umbilical cord. And you even when you first become pregnant, I mean, all these mothers can verify that you start getting attached even before you get to see your child. Just to know that it's your child, that attachment comes very, very strong. The affection grows and grows, especially when they come out. Of course, Krishna makes them so that they're really cute. So you, even though it's austere, you take care of them. You just can't can't stand not seeing the cute little thing. Even, you know, you'll see pictures of little piglets and you think, oh, they're just so cute, little wiggly tail and everything. You can't resist them, right? Or all these little animals. Krishna makes it that way, so you protect them. This protection, like Devaki, she laments because she didn't get to protect her children. So now she's taking advantage of Krishna and asking for them to see them again. But she, you know, always thinking of how you have to protect them. You know, Mother Yasoda was thinking, oh, the monkeys and the diseases and this and the dirt and everything. She's always worried about Krishna putting that little black string. I think that's like a talisman or something for protection. I don't know all these things. Probably the Indian ladies know what all those things are. Tiger tooth or something. And different mantras Yasoda would be saying all the time, blessing this and calling out for all these different different demigods and personalities, protect every part of his body. So this also nurtures that bond, that strong bond, which we should have with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because we see in the material world that motherly affection and bond. All of a sudden, when it gets to be, you know, starting around 13, that independent mode clicks in, and all of a sudden the mother is in the way of my sense gratification. She's telling me, I can't do this. I have to do this. I have to wear my hair this way. I have to wear this kind of clothes. I can't associate with so-and-so. And then sometimes that love can actually turn into hate. So that's the difference where this material love is really not the true love that we eternally have for our Supreme Lord. Although we blew it also with our independent attitude and lost our real respect for the Supreme Lord. It's described in the material world that to be a teacher is like a thankless task. Motherhood is also, guru, I imagine, also is a thankless task. It's so much work. It's so difficult. But the devotee, when you understand you're a devotee, you realize that actually I have so much regret for taking that advantage of that independence and losing Supreme Lord's contact, that actually I should see Krishna as my mother, as my father. That nice song in Nadia Godrumi, it says, being careful to remain free of offenses, just take the holy name of Krishna. Krishna is your mother, Krishna is your father, and Krishna is a treasure of your life. So this is the devotee's real understanding that Krishna is, we should have all that affection that we have for our mother and father, and it actually becomes Krishna's our life and soul. So this means we have to humble ourselves and understand our real position, and that we do really need Krishna. And then when we call out for Krishna, he'll come. Just like, I know that I like to be somewhere where I'm needed. I think everybody does. You don't like to just, you know, be worthless. You want to be needed. And therefore, when Krishna realizes that he's needed, he'll come. So if you call for him with that great need, Prabhupada said, call out like a child for the mother, then he'll surely come. And we know that, because when we chant our japa very nicely in a humble state of mind, we can keep chanting and chanting. It gets sweeter and sweeter, because you feel Krishna is pleased. He has come. He realizes he should come. You're begging so much. It's kind of hard to have that cry for a child from a mother, but we need to practice that and experience that humility, because really Krishna is like, well, you know, Prabhupada always writes his letters and says that he's our well-wisher. He's representing Krishna, who is also our well-wisher. And I was thinking it's more like they're like our caregiver, because we're completely diseased and helpless and really don't know how to behave properly. I've been with my mother recently, and she's at the point now in her life where she is helpless, and she admits it. And actually, she's becoming a little humble, believe it or not. And she has these caregivers come in, you know, $15 an hour. They come in, and you can imagine. I watched them come, and each one's a little different. You know, they have a different attitude. It's not easy to be a caregiver. Very, very difficult, and because you don't even know this person, you're supposed to like, you know, try to make them, you know, happy and take care of them with some kind of, you know, caring attitude, an affection. And it really makes a difference. And my mother found that actually, if she's nice to them, they're even nicer to her. But they actually have to be nice anyway, or they try to be. I guess some of them are just thinking about the $15 an hour. But when we think Krishna, actually, he's having to take care of us in our helpless condition. And he doesn't have to worry about the $15 an hour, but he does it because he really does care for us. He wants us to become healthy again and to come back to him. He really wants that more than we want to go back. We were reading last night in the Chaitanya Charitamrita of a nice example of how Lord Chaitanya would care for his devotees. It's the pastime when Sanatana Goswami has gone through the Jharkhand forest and got the diseases, and he comes and Lord Chaitanya embraces him anyway. And then he arranges. He says, okay, now Sanatana Goswami, you stay here with Haridas Thakur and just talk Krishna Katha and just be together. And I will come personally. I'll go to the temple. I'll make arrangements that you get the prasadam. I'll come here every day and bring you all prasadam, so you don't have to worry about that. You can just be in ecstasy about with Krishna. And I was thinking, what a caregiver Lord Chaitanya is. And he's so kind to us too. He's given us the holy name. He's given us Krishna on a silver plate. So easy. We just take it, the holy name, and we can be with him. So we should have that that strong affection and pray. Okay, you know, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Please engage me again. I stepped out of my occupation. I blooped. Okay, now can I have my duty back? Can I please serve you again? And so we have to realize that in the beginning, I know for myself, it's been a matter of duty. That yes, okay, I need to serve. I need to serve my spiritual master every day. I have to do as much as I possibly can this lifetime. But then at some point we have to see the duty turn into devotion. And it's promised that it will. And therefore it's Prabhupada gave us the nectar of devotion. He put us at the feet of the six Goswamis, and they take care of us, the nectar of instruction, nectar of devotion, are our law books, and we should study them deeply, because they are waves. In the very first couple of waves, there's like four waves, we can wade through this practice, get our toes a little bit wet on how to act properly and what not to do, what to do, what Krishna likes. And then we go into a little bit more deeper of Krishna's pastimes and become a little bit more attracted, how wonderful he is. And then all of a sudden the waves get really high. I don't know about you, but they're like the last couple of, you know, the few last chapters are like, they're too high. I'm not ready for that yet. But we can see that it is this practice, this bhakti marg, Lord Chaitanya and our spiritual master have put our feet on this path, and with the help of the devotees, we will gradually come to the point of devotion, as we hear from Shraddha all the way to Prema. So we're not quite as lucky as Devaki and other eternal associates. Devaki, you know, has that spontaneous love for Krishna, but we can, you know, stick to our path, and we will have great hope that we will make it. There was other people, like in Lord Chaitanya's pastimes, that had this spontaneous love for Godhead, and they shared it. Lord Chaitanya, of course, shared it. He would just touch somebody in South India. He would just touch somebody, and they would become ecstatic with love of Godhead. And that person was so empowered that they would go and they would go and touch somebody, and then the whole of South India was becoming immersed in this ecstatic love for God. There was one other eternal associate, Sridham, in Lord Chaitanya's Leela, Abhiram Thakur, and he had a magical whip. I think it was Jai Mangala, I can't remember. I think the name Jai Mangala had a whip, and he would just whip the other devotees, and they would become ecstatic and have love of Godhead. So that was made pretty easy. But we do have it easy. We should appreciate that we're being escorted by Lord Chaitanya and Srila Prabhupada through this process of purification, and they are making it very easy for to go back home to Godhead, and to be able to see it as a labor of love, just like for a mother. It's a labor of love. You're hoping that the children will love you their whole lifetime and appreciate you. It's not without sacrifice. So we have to also understand that this sacrifice should be our ecstasy. I'm sure Devaki, she also, her austerity, she had a different rasa of the anxiety being her pleasure. So in the same way, we go through some anxiety, but we should see that as our pleasure also. There's so much sacrifice in motherhood. I know it's not Mother's Day or anything, but it should go understood that we should be respectful. That's where we lose it. If we're not respectful, then we have a tendency to make offense. So these two things have to be very very much clear in our activities. That if we're respectful, then for everyone, then how are we going to be offensive? So if you look at a mother, it's said actually in the Manusamhita that the mother is 10,000 times more worshipable than the guru. Of course, in this age, motherhood is a whole different program. When you think of Kunti, Mother Kunti, when she said, "Oh, very nice. Share whatever you have with your son, with your brothers." That was the law. That's what Mom said. But oh my gosh! So they shared their wife. That was how respected the mother was. Paying all the children would pay their obeisances in the morning. Even till just recently, the mothers, they had say in the marriages, and they had say in what the girls did and things like that. Now it's like, your mother's over there, I'm going this way. It's unfortunate. But I think we need to reestablish it in our society somehow or other. I don't know how. I hope you all have some suggestions how we can get the mothers in this movement to be more respected by their children. I think that would help for the future of the society, because we really need to make sure that there aren't any offenses, because it does disrupt so much in the whole society at large. So that means that you first deserve, then desire. So if you want to be respected, one has to be in that position of mother, being very, very much devoted and dedicated, and very much in knowledge of the scriptures, and pure, and so many different things. There was a picture on Facebook of a devotee lady, a young lady, who had like 13 arms or something like that, a java bag, one arm, a spoon in another. I don't know, there must have been like 16 arms, and all the different things that mothers have to do. Is that going to be some answer for them? I don't know how, and maybe you all have some ideas, besides, of course, the mothers coming up to that standard of how to you know, be more respectful to them and to everybody, actually. So we're in demand right now to become more purified so this movement can go forward, because offenses do put a stumbling block, an obstacle. So we can understand from these different stories that we're not exempt, that if we do make offense, there it will be some repercussion from this. So maybe you all have some ideas how we can become more respectful. Do any of your daughters come and pay your basins this morning, things like that? No? We really, I don't know how we can do that, but it should be really established again. So little by little, we can get this culture back together. I think it starts in the beginning, in the very beginning days, you know? And it's hard because it's hard for us to accept some, you know, respect. Actually, I noticed this new boy, Blake, when he saw Mother Ruchira, he paid his obeisances, and she went, like, you know, she was a little embarrassed, but that's the proper training, you know, that this couple has brought me to the movement. I should do some service for them. I should bow my head to them. I think that's one thing we could do is when we're training the young bhaktas and things to be very respectful. It doesn't hurt to bow your head as many times as you can in a day. Who was it? One of the six Goswamis, maybe it was Raghunath Das, that would bind 2,000 devotees to pay their obeisance to every single day. Okay, you have something to say.
So I was thinking this etiquette should be taught at home from small, and then they should be reminded. But I know when the kids actually go out, you know, to the outside world, then they become highly influenced by other kids, and they see, you know. But if they are constantly reminded, I think it eventually would form something in the heart, and they may be a little more respectful.
Yeah, constant practice, just like our on Bhakti Marg, we have to constantly practice what we learn. If it could be encouraged and then followed through, that would be, I think, a great benediction for this movement, is to actually go in that direction rather than being scared to tell your kids what to do and afraid that they might not like you or something. You have that mic? Have some water.
From my personal experience, I think the men, the husbands, play a huge role in that, teaching the children to respect their mothers. Like from personal experience, I grew up with a stepfather who really wasn't around, and I never really was installed that as a child. So my teenage years, needless to say, I was kind of, my mother worked in the city, I was never, you know, I was like, I'm going out, and I never really listened or anything. But I met my biological father, thankfully, when I was in my late teens, and he was very, you know, religious, stand-up guy. He really installed that into me, like, how important it is to respect your mother and how scriptures say to respect your mother and this and that. And, I really think, like, it's difficult for a mother to say, like, you have to respect me, but if the husband is there and says and teaches the child from when they're small, you respect your mother, you do this, you do that and stuff. It's more of a, especially if it's a boy, like, they listen automatically. Mm-hmm. And so I think as men, as husbands and things like that, it's almost like a duty to teach our children to respect mother.
Thank you. That's a good suggestion. Madame Mohan, Prabhu.
Well, sometimes you could see it as a symptom of a larger problem. And of course, the Vedic culture was based on knowledge, you know, that there's what is matter and what is spirit, and the control of both. And then there was duty that one understood in the, from the mode of goodness, certain things that you do that elevate you. And that was the predominant consciousness in duty, because we know from the story of Daksha and Lord Shiva that when Daksha came, when he saw Lord Shiva didn't offer his obeisances. And in the purports there, Prabhupada explains that the obeisances are to the super soul, not specifically. So it's a general overall idea that we're seeing Krishna, and Krishna's arranged these, even though sometimes parents are called fallible soldiers and the family members, that we're seeing here's the presence of Krishna. Krishna's arranged this for me, and I do it in a mode of goodness and as duty. Then all the other aspects come, because otherwise it's more or less a social custom or some other part, but it's not so strongly supported. Shastra Deva to do it.
Over here, she has something to say.
Thank you, Mataji. My question is about cultivating the etiquettes and respectful behavior among the children. So from my personal experience, I was born and brought up in a sort of Vedic civilizations and in a sort of village culture. So in there we can see I was grown up in a joint family atmosphere where grandparents were there, and automatically from their association we were able to observe how to deal with the elder people and what should be our attitude towards them. But nowadays it's only mother and father and child, and certain cases sometimes only father and child or only mother and child. It has come to that level, they are not able to properly observe and get into that mode of Vedic viewpoints in their own childhood days. So, and also because of that, there are certain familiarities that children develop towards their parents, because parents think that, okay, they are totally depending on their parents and certain things we have to be flexible with them, and they sometimes take it as granted, and certain sort of familiarities developed for them towards the parents, and we sort of lack that Vedic, we are forced to go against certain sometimes. So how to deal with those familiarities in today's time, so that, because in olden days children will used to have some sort of fearful respect towards their parents, or not because of punishments, but that sort of mentality. But now there is no punishment, and then children are very familiar with their parents. They can ask anything, they can share anything. Of course, no one is there to share for them. So how to deal with those familiarities so that at the same time they can develop a respectful relationship with the parents?
Well, we can't say that it's impossible, and we have to realize that now we have to reestablish. To reestablish or to rebuild anything is more difficult than building it, actually. So you're going to be a grandmother, and they're going to think, okay, so my grandmother. So you, right now, you have to realize that it's not too late. Just like he said, he was in his late teens, and his father started getting heavy with him, you know, or instructing him on how he should behave. So it's not too late. You can start telling your children that this is what to do, and then they can tell their children, see, your grandmother, she also. So we can't expect someone else to do it. The answers aren't out there. The answers are that we each one of us in the room has to do it, and it's not hard. For some of us we can lament it's too late. We should have done things differently. But all we can do is realize it. Somehow or other, we have to reestablish. Prabhupada really wants us to reestablish some of these principles. Not easy. Madhumati, she knows the answers.
I was thinking the family unit, like Rami Prabhu was saying, family unit has changed over the years, but that's where a child learns. I think it's not so much by telling, it's by example. So even if the family unit, let's say if the nuclear with the husband and wife and child is there, if the child learns how the mother is respecting the husband, that's how they learn how to respect elders, because the husband, let's say, is the head of the family. And then from how the husband is responding to the wife, the father to the mother, they learn how to give affection to the younger. Now, in a situation where we just have in the family just the mother or the father and the child, it's just not, that itself is not just a family, especially in a community we have. We have so many uncles and aunts. So how, let's say it's just the mother and the child, how the mother is respecting the other devotees, how she is dealing with other devotees, is she criticizing them in the house? Or she's giving them respect. How she is dealing with the other younger devotees to her. Kids absorb everything. So you can tell them, like Prabhupada talks about, a very simple thing. You're smoking and telling the child not to smoke, that's not going to take you anywhere. But how you're dealing, how is the mother dealing, how is the father dealing, how is they dealing with the community members, how are they respecting them, how are they taking care of them? And that's what really, that's how children learn. So even if you have a nuclear family or you have just a mother or a father, still they will absorb how you're dealing with everybody else.
That's what I answer. Mahatma.
Yes, Hare Krishna. The point is that we all are coming from dysfunctional families. So that's the first point. So the second point is to realize that. And the third point is to adopt a family. Like single parents, you know, we can adopt someone. Even they do that in the regular schools nowadays, for kindergarten or preschool, they are actually hiring or asking grandma volunteers to come in the classrooms, because it's so needed. It's just so needed. So same thing with our community. We can also ask someone, would you be willing to be the grandma? Today I was holding the hand of this girl, and there were other girls in the room, and I say, go with them. Aren't you friends? And she says, yeah, she comes with her father only. Her mother is there, but she, you know, she is busy probably working too. But I said, go with the girls. And she goes, but I'd like to be with you. So, you know, that the need for the kids to have extended family is there. So it's up to us to actually do the thing.
A couple of people over here. Where's the mic?
I was going to talk about the ISKCON family, and you mentioned about Bhakta Blake offers his obeisances to Mother Ruchira. Just a question to you, were you taught to do that, or did that just come natural?
I've been involved in some form of Hinduism for a long time, so I've observed, you know, people given obeisances and pranams. So Adikarta and Ruchira gave me life, so I feel like I owe them a lot more, so it's the least that I can do. But they're very, for instance, last night we went to Adi Karthanarjuna's house. He took me to the other room and told me, hey, you can do that in private if you want, but don't do it in public. They're very much embarrassed by it. They're very humble.
It's a good example. I don't know. We're afraid to...
I was going to say that when we first joined the movement a long time ago, we used to spend most of our morning offering obeisances.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, before you could chant japa, it was like down on the ground, down on the ground, down on the ground, down on the ground. Because when we first moved in, we were all taught to pay your respects to all your fellow devotees, because it was something that you were taught to do and that you enjoyed showing your respect, like said, to people who are helping you become Krishna conscious. And I was just wondering, because now we're sort of like a community. We're not just this small band of warriors coming together. We're a giant community. We've become, obviously, a little less personal. So, you know, you're not going to drop to the ground in the supermarket when you see somebody.
Well, it's all condensed now. Mancha kalpa tarubhyas cha kalpa. So we all do it.
Right. We do that one time. That's it for the day. Yeah. But, I mean, there are still devotees who are being taught to do that because, you know, like the brahmacharis that do the books from...
Dhanavir's
guys. When I was down in Miami, I walked in the temple room and they hit the ground right away. I was like, wow, I haven't seen that for ages. And then they did it the next day. It's like, whoa, they did it the next day. So it's something they were taught to do, to pay obeisances when an older devotee comes into the room in the temple. So... I was just wondering, is it because we are so big now and that we have a community as opposed to just this small group, and we've become less personal because of that, and we don't sort of respect, you know, because we're like Christian church now, so to speak, you know. On a Sunday, a big Sunday thing there, everybody shows up and says, well, these people you didn't even realize were devotees are devotees. So it's not like a fine... A dark line that you know, oh, he's a devotee, he's now not a devotee. We're all sort of devotees now in one way or another, so we don't respect that, maybe? I don't know. I don't know what I'm trying to say.
I think
maybe you do.
Each one of us can go in our hearts and realize what has changed. And I think we can see the results of it. Maybe we should go back to the being a little bit more respectful. Doesn't hurt. Okay, one last one.
As far as the etiquettes are concerned, I think etiquettes are not just subject to etiquettes of being obeisances, but it's also about general mannerism. For example, if you're sitting in a group of devotees, the children need to be taught to acknowledge the adults who are present and at least greet them with a Hare Krishna or a Hari Bol. It begins with that. It's not about just paying obeisances. The respect filters down all the way from how you greet the person on a daily basis and how you respect them. So that's the first beginning. And to address what Mataji was saying, being in a nuclear family, again, it's a joint family, that definitely makes a very huge difference. But my personal experience has been that 25 years we lived in the Caribbean as a nuclear family, away from all our family, and we were brought up with these etiquettes. We could not pay obeisances to our parents when we would talk to them over the phone, but we then started verbalizing it. Please accept my obeisances, but we would say it like my pranams to you. That means pranams is actually an act. But we then verbalized it so the children were conscious of it. And then we started talking to children how we would have different... It was very awkward to tell the children, you have to come and respect me. And rightfully what he mentioned is, my husband said that, you know what, you should do it to your mom. Or I said, you should do it to your father. So we started by telling the children that on special occasions and days, like their birthdays, when it was Diwali, when it was festivals, or when they before they go for the exams, things like that, they started doing it. And that has kind of fallen into a practice that they still do today. Like when the kids would go for the exams, they would still call us, like Vinda is away, but she'd still call and she'll offer it over the phone. And
if they are there physically, they will still do it when they have an exemption for mom and special blessings kind of, and you know, we would do that. So it's not impossible, it's just how we desire that it should come down. And as soon as they are back into the family realm, back in India, as soon as they land, they right away will pay obeisances. That's the first thing, the moment, before they even exchange a word, the first thing they will do is offer pranam and, you know, bend down to take the blessing. So I think it's not an impossible, but it comes with factors, plus how conscious we are of wanting to inculcate that into the children.
Gradual process can be done. Now it's Pam Ho. That's what we have. Jai Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai.